and particularly 2 Corinthians, which is where my expertise lies most, Paul spends a lot of time talking about how Jesus embodies strength or power in weakness. And so I think part of the issue there is that you're dealing with a lot of Christians who don't spend enough time in certain parts of the canon. And that's an error that goes right back to the beginning. And I think that's part of the problem, is we're just not realizing that Christianity has some things to say about power and how you use it.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the CPT Podcast. Today, we are continuing our conversation with CPT fellow Ben White, who is a professor of biblical studies and theology at the King's College in Midtown Manhattan. We are talking with Ben today about some of his PhD research on strength and weakness in 2 Corinthians, as well as how this applies to life in the church.
Get us into your dissertation research and how that emerged.
Yep. So going back to when I was in ministry, just before heading off to Durham, I was preaching a fair bit. The church had an evening service, which is naturally the forum for a junior pastor on staff. And so I was preaching all the time in that evening service. And they let me choose whatever I wanted to preach. I was never told, here, do a series. They just said, you know, whatever you want to do, do it. And so I kind of hopped around the canon, preaching in the Old Testament, preaching in the New. Nice. And I eventually was really drawn to 2 Corinthians. You know, I'd specialized in Paul at Regent, but I just found that conversation about weakness to be really compelling. Mm. And ever since then, I've been asking myself why that was, which is maybe a whole nother rabbit trail we could go down. Why was I personally drawn to that? But I think one element of it was I was reading commentaries on 2 Corinthians and trying to make sense of strength and weakness, which as a pastor, naturally, you gravitate to that. That's the theological climax of the letter. It's so relevant and powerful for a person sitting in the pew, right? Paul finds strength in his weaknesses. So come on. You've already hit.
That'll preach.
That's a base hit already just by choosing that text for your sermon, you know? But I couldn't make sense of it. And I remember preaching on 2 Corinthians 12, 9 to 10. And my wife, you know, naturally you have these, by this point I'm married, and Brittany is a wonderful conversation partner for theology. But, you know, as usual, the pastor gets down, the preacher gets down and talks to the spouse, and they always have the most insightful comments. and she said, and this is a credit to her, so I'm sharing this as a positive thing. She said, you know, Ben, it seemed like you were searching for something, but you didn't quite get there.
Oh, what a pointed statement. I mean, what a profound statement.
And I thought, totally. I agree with you. And you know what? I think it's not just me. I think it's that we're all struggling to get there. And so the wheels just started churning. And I started thinking, how much work has actually been done on strength and weakness? Do we actually have a satisfactory understanding of it? Do we understand the way 2 Corinthians works? I was feeling like I couldn't figure it out. And so it just became a natural curiosity. And so I was actually supposed to study something else entirely. I think it was table fellowship and human value and stuff in 1 Corinthians, actually. I showed up in Durham, my first meeting with John, and I just said, nope, I want to do strength and weakness in 2 Corinthians. And that's kind of where we went from there.
Marvelous. Well, you teed it up nicely, Ben. What is it about your psyche? I couldn't resist asking the follow-up on that.
True. Yeah, you know, you should ask a counselor or something that I've talked to. They can explain it more. Yep. I think it's several things. Part of it was, honestly, just I found it inherently interesting. I thought it was an understudied part of Paul's letters, but personally, I think part of it has to do with being an introvert and to some degree with where I'm from, being from Canada and trying to make your way in the theological world, right? Name the best Canadian theologian. You'll struggle with that, right? And that's not to say that there aren't good theologians in Canada. They're amazing. I mean, they've made me who I am now. But I think there's a sense in which I always felt like an outsider to some degree. And in academia, one of the most important things is that you kind of stand up and you talk, right? And this is one of the funny things. You know, a lot of people will say academics, they're all introverts. You don't have to talk. You just sit in your office. That's not true. That's not true at all.
Yeah.
It's like saying basketball isn't a contact sport. It's like, I understand why you think that, but it's totally not true. In academia, you have to be authoritative. You have to talk with confidence. You have to get up there and say, this is what I think. This is why I think it. You have to listen to me because I've got the goods. I've got the intellectual goods. And for me, as this kind of soft-spoken introverted person, I prefer to think before I speak. You know, I'd be sitting at Regent in the upper level Pauline seminar, and my professor would have to call on me and say, Ben, do you have anything to say? And I'd say, well, I'm still thinking about it. And she'd say, no, I really want you to just say whatever you're thinking about. And I'm like, well, okay, here it is. And it would just totally change the course of the conversation. And so for me, it's been this kind of gradual unfolding of learning that actually maybe I do have strengths, maybe I do have something to say, but actually those strengths come from exactly those things that might cause people to overlook my contribution or overlook my personality, because I'm sitting back there and I'm processing until I have something to say. And so I think it was a lot to do with my persona and just my experience of human interactions and trying to be authoritative and creating a direction for myself vocationally that led to all of that.
Is it too much of a stretch, Ben, to say, and feel free to swat this down if this is just nonsense, but the experience, I mean, you mentioned being Canadian, having a part to play in this. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned earlier in the conversation, this gigantic behemoth to the south of Canada called the U.S. I mean, seriously, is there any, and you were, and as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, you were kind of politically aware and interested. Is there anything about growing up Canadian with this massive behemoth that's cast this long shadow over your country, whether you like it or not, that just forces Canadians, in a way it probably doesn't Americans, to wrestle with this power-weakness dynamic, even in a political sense.
Yep.
Is there anything to that?
Well, if you were to talk to some of my compatriots, they would say no, or they would look at you with kind of a confused look. So when I talk to other Canadians, some of them get really confused.
Yes.
Or they just think I'm plain wrong. So I'm in the process of writing something for Faith Today, which is Canada's version of Christianity Today. And the editors accepted the article, and it's kind of on this topic. You know, what does it mean to be Canadian? What does it mean to build momentum in a country that often looks south for inspiration?
Yes.
How can we create inspiration here? How can we gain momentum here? And they had some interesting jibes about that stuff. So it's interesting talking about it. But I think you're on the exact track there, Todd. For me, just understanding my spiritual biography, it's been a lot of thinking about what does it mean to be Canadian, trying to make your way in a theological world that is overly defined by the United States and Britain.
Right.
And Germany to a degree. You know, those three countries really kind of lead the pack. I think it has a lot to do with that. And you see that in Canada. Canada is incredibly wealthy. It's incredibly privileged. It actually, on certain rankings, like the Human Development Index, it finishes well beyond the United States.
Yes.
Yet Canadians often come across as very soft-spoken. They prefer to only speak when spoken to. They don't want to stand up and be really confident because that seems fake. That seems too American, frankly, for a lot of Canadians.
Yes.
And it's actually to the point. This is a great anecdote, which I have in the article that's going to come out with Faith Today. Masai Ujiri, who is a Nigerian-born general manager of the Toronto Raptors, okay, and crafted their championship team in 2019, as they were working towards becoming the first non-American franchise to win an NBA championship, he kept getting faced with questions about, well, you know, American NBA players don't want to come to Canada. Can a Canadian franchise really capture the NBA championship? And at one point, there's this famous press conference where he just kind of threw down the gauntlet and said, you know what? I don't know why all of you lack so much confidence in your city. I don't know why you lack so much confidence in your country. That those days are over. Toronto is the most diverse city in the world, according to the United Nations. This city is powerful.
Amazing city,
this city
yes.
is a place where people want to be. So stop lacking so much confidence and start owning what you have here. This is a great, compelling place.
Mm.
You know, and it took a Nigerian to say that to a bunch of Canadian reporters, right? And that to me just kind of typifies some of the dynamics there.
Hey, everybody, just a quick note about the CPT's annual theology conference for 2021. The theme this year is Confronting Racial Injustice, Theory and Praxis for the Church. This event will take place on October 18th to 20th at Calvary Memorial Church just outside of Chicago. Plenary speakers include Charlie Dates, Eric Redmond, Esau McCulley, Raymond Chang, Cherith V. Nordling, Gregory Thompson, and Love Seacrest. You can register and find more information at cptconference.com.
All of this, you know, your personal story and then these academic interests and research and power and weakness, I mean, you've already touched on it, Ben, but just want to return to it now, has set you up, it seems to me, so well to be teaching at King's in downtown Manhattan and forming students to engage the city and culture in New York City. I mean, just elaborate a little bit on that. I mean, I just love hearing your story and these threads that come together in this beautiful way, setting you up to with the platform you now have in such a good way, it seems to me.
Yeah. So when I interviewed at King's, it helped that I studied with John Barclay. That was a big thing. It helped that as a kid, I lived in the metro New York City area. Because as I said, my dad's job, we were down here for a couple of years. So I could talk as an outsider. I could talk intelligently about what the New York City area is like, places I'd want to live, you know, stuff like that. That helped. But the thing they actually said they really loved was my thesis and my overall kind of disposition. Because when I got to the campus visit stage, I gave a lecture, and I'm missing the exact title right now, but it was something about shame and power and dealing with modern instances of shame in a New York City context on, you know, on social media, on all these kinds of things. Because there's what happens in New York to an 18 or 19 year old or even a 21 year old. They show up and the city is just built on the backbone of outward success, right? If you're in New York City, you're hustling. If you're not hustling, you're getting hustled. Everybody's really good at what they do, and they talk about how good they are at what they do. And it's just natural, right? The city is a seat of power. And what happens is you get these students, as well as just New Yorkers generally, who will build this facade of strength. I have it all together. Yes. And my job as a New Testament professor is to see past that, you know, and to sort of say, I think you're really talented, but you know, there are also a lot of vulnerabilities that the city is exposing. There are a lot of things that you're struggling with. And here's how the Christian faith can help you with this by worshiping and following a Jesus who was crucified and resurrected. You know, you could kill him, but you couldn't keep him dead. Mm-hmm. And so trying to find that unrelenting hope in the face of our vulnerabilities and weaknesses, I think, is one of the magical things that the Christian faith does for students and for anybody.
Yeah, I New York, I love that connection you've made, Todd. I think with Ben, your temperament, your research, this your heritage as a Canadian, now being in Midtown Manhattan. I don't know if I'm saying anything new here, other than saying like I feel like this is all really interesting because there are few cities that could like lay claim to the imaginary title of like capital of planet Earth, but if like New York would be one of them that you could make an argument for. So it's just like and what you're talking about teaching, you know, undergrads, like the kind of insecurity and vulnerability and like a playing at competence that I think is characteristic of young people. In that kind of college age group, that is actually a thin veil over like deep vulnerability and insecurity in the middle of the capital of planet Earth. You know, I that's interesting stuff to me. At an evangelical institution.
That's right.
You know,
that's
like
right.
that's a lot of kind of cool things coming together.
Yeah. And the thing that I'm most proud of in some ways is that all of this really contributes to what the King's College is. You know, it's a small Christian college. We're talking 400, 500 students, yet we punch above our weight. You know, yeah. We have students who go on to the Ivy League. I've personally helped students get there. They go on to have these awesome internships because the city just sets them alight. You know, if they can hack it and they can, you know, in a safe environment that we provide as a college, they get through that first year or two. They end up thriving because New York City presents limitless possibilities, really. And so a lot of our graduates, you know, they come through a bit of a trial, you know, adjusting to the city and things like this. But then coming out of that, you know, they're stronger for it and better prepared, I think, for dealing with what the country is going to be like 20, 30 years from now. Because that's the thing about New York City. It's kind of a harbinger of what the rest of the United States will be like in the future, right?
Yeah.
So it's amazing working there. And it's a place that is strategic in many ways. And I would say that whether I worked there or not.
Oh, that's marvelous. Ben, there's been a lot of things in the news, and quite a few of them have been heartbreaking and tragic about evangelicalism and its relationship to power and power dynamics. It seems to me that the evangelical church, at least in North America, is having a reckoning with power and and dysfunctional uses of power, unbiblical ways of thinking about power. And I'll kind of do an underhanded toss to you, non-Pauline, non-2 Corinthians ways of handling power. I would love for you just to share with us some of your reflections, kind of with your Pauline hat on, deeply immersed in these things, with this biblical lens, and then to look out on the evangelical landscape and just give some commentary for us.
Yeah. It's obviously a massive topic, and I'm approaching this as a New Testament guy, but I do read a bit of culture inside. So here goes. I think a lot of this could begin, especially in evangelical circles, with the fact that we don't want to think about power. And that's actually what Andy Crouch says in one of his books. He's a wonderful thinker, by the way, on power,
yes,
Andy Crouch. As evangelicals, we so often say that the gospel, the heart of our faith, rests, in terms of Paul, within something like Romans and Galatians. And yeah. I don't dispute that to a degree. Those are the height, really, of what Paul does. They're wonderful, terribly clear letters. But there are other letters, and those letters have elements of Paul's gospel as well. And so that's where you get into 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians, and particularly 2 Corinthians, which is where my expertise lies most. Paul spends a lot of time talking about how Jesus embodies strength or power in weakness. Mm. And so I think part of the issue there is that you're dealing with a lot of Christians who don't spend enough time in certain parts of the canon. And that's an error that goes right back to the beginning, right?
Yes,
where you
yes.
have someone like Marcion cutting away parts of the canon. You know, a lot of us are functional Marcionites, whether
yes.
we realize it or not. And I think that's part of the problem, is we're just not realizing that Christianity has some things to say about power and how you use it or how you embody it. So that's kind of the beginning.
I would say, if I can just interject quickly here,
yeah.
even on Paul, I mean, you alluded to this, you know, you talk about canon within a canon. Many people talk about canon within a canon, I should say. And within the kind of broadly Protestant tradition, Paul is favored and as kind of the center of Protestant theological biblical identity is Pauline. But what you were getting at is that even within Paul, we have a canon within a canon, where it's not just the Pauline corpus, but it's actually these two letters, Galatians and Romans, that have become the center of Protestant theological identity. And I just wanted to kind of interject that there's a lot of other things that Paul says, and that actually, like the Corinthian correspondence and elsewhere, become really important to how you read Galatians and Romans.
Yes.
And I think the Yeah, just like I think you're right to point out that there's something really, I hesitate to say central, but really profound and unique and powerful about the discussions on justification in these forensic categories, which feature in Galatians and Romans. But I think there is a tendency, there's a tendency to look too closely at Galatians and Romans, not just at the expense of the broader canon, but at the expense of Paul as a thinker, as an apostle. So I just wanted to get those two cents in before.
No, that's helpful clarification, Vic. Yeah, absolutely. Especially what you said there at the beginning, how Paul, for better or for worse, defines so much of Protestant and evangelical identity and theology. Mm-hmm. If you change the way you read Paul, it ends up changing almost everything else. And so that's why I think spending more time studying things other than Romans and Galatians, you know, asking yourself, when you say Paul, what do we mean by Paul? Right. Yeah. for some people, you know, and I think this is really important. And
we're hurting Todd's feelings because he's studied Galatians.
I'm feeling wounded. I studied Galatians for a very good reason. If you can figure out Galatians, you've got Paul, you've got the New Testament, you've got biblical Christianity. Come on. That's the syllogism, bro.
Most Protestant thing I've ever heard. Like,
and I can narrow it down. If you get law gospel in Galatians, yes. Then you've got everything. Mm-hmm.
Yes, these two verses are literally the center of the Bible.
Totally. You know, it's interesting, though. You know, Luther, you think, you know, Protestant figures, Luther, of course, is deeply associated with Galatians and Romans, but he sees different uses for different letters. So in his polemical treatises or constructive theology treatises, it's Galatians and Romans. But if you read his pastoral literature, which is, you know, how do you distinguish that? For Luther, it's all pastoral, I think. But his quote-unquote pastoral letters or soul care stuff, it's 2 Corinthians 12:9 that he quotes more than anything else. Beautiful, in his pastoral letters and things like that. And so even for Luther, you know, what Protestantism is and what we're supposed to be doing, you know, it can look different depending on which question you're asking.
Marvelous. Ben, if folks want to dig deeper in these power dynamics, Paul, New Testament study stuff, I mean, obviously take a look at your dissertation. And where else would you point them? You mentioned Andy Crouch's work on power that you're appreciative of. Other accessible volumes to go take a look at or articles that you'd point folks to?
Yeah. So the dissertation for me comes out with Moore Zeebeck here next month. It's called Pain and Paradox in 2 Corinthians, the Transformative Function of Strength and Weakness. But it's obviously a technical work. So if you've got facility in New Testament studies, that book might be helpful for you. But in terms of looking more broadly, you know, at a pastoral level or a lay level, there are a few books actually that I'd totally recommend. Andy Crouch, Strong and Weak is good. Paradox Lost by Richard Hansen is really good. So that's a Zondervan title.
Nice.
Where he tries to mine the conceptual frameworks of paradox and show that actually this has a pastoral function. Right. So, to just give you a quick sampling of what that means, you know, a lot of people out there in the wider world will say that strength and weakness is the property of their conception of life. Oh yeah. Strength and weakness. I love that. Right. And they're a secular humanist or something, but usually what they mean is they convert a weakness to a strength.
Yeah. Okay?
The Christian conception is no. It's not a conversion of your weakness. Like God puts strength there and it displaces your weakness, which is the way a lot of Christians talk. That's not it.
Yes.
God keeps your weakness there. Okay. The thorn in the flesh. I know. Right. In chapter 12, 2 Corinthians, Paul wants the thorn in the flesh to leave. What's the thorn in the flesh? We don't know. Some people think it's a struggle with lust. Other people think it's a physical ailment. Who knows? It's something that's bothering him. God doesn't take it away. He just says, my grace is sufficient for you. This is the risen Jesus. My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. And so what you have there is a simultaneous redemption of the weakness that leaves the weakness as it was. It was a weakness, but it is now changed and is paradoxically congruent with strength. And so it's transformed to become productive and useful for the Christian life. Mm. And it can help you. And my thesis talks about this at a very high level. It can help you to love. It can help you to express proper humility. It can do all kinds of things for you. Richard Hansen gets into some of those conceptual things.
Marvelous.
Also helpful, Lutheran theologians. Okay, some Lutherans will get into what they call the theology of the cross, which isn't quite strength and weakness stuff. It's different, but it's very close. One book that's been really helpful for me is Lighten Our Darkness by Douglas John Hall. So he was a theologian who was actually in the footnotes. Okay, this is a really nerdy comment, but if you read Fleming Rutledge's The Crucifixion, right, which is an awesome book, right, Christianity Today award-winning book, in the footnotes, she heavily praises this book, Lighten Our Darkness by Douglas John Hall. I discovered it before I read Rutledge, but I'm just throwing it out there for the lay folks out there. Excellent. You know, why is this actually a good book? Well, if you don't take my word for it, take Fleming Rutledge's word for it. And he basically directs his attention to what he calls the officially optimistic religion of North America. He thinks we're too optimistic, too focused on positive thinking. And his basic message, which has really impacted me, is that the power of Christianity is found in being able to stare something like death in the face and say, in the name of Jesus, I know that you won't win.
Beautiful.
Right? It's this ability to not look past the suffering, but to also, as you look at it, to know that it does not define you. It is not everything about you, and it ultimately will not win. And actually, there might be in the middle of that darkness something that helps you.
Beautiful.
But not the darkness in itself that's helping you. It's God transforming and changing that darkness by his grace to become something that's useful. And that's what Paul calls strength and weakness.
A fabulous note to end on, Ben. And some great resources there for folks to check out. Thanks for being with us. Great conversation, brother.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the CPT Podcast, a theology podcast for the church. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider throwing us a like, sharing the podcast online, subscribing, leaving a review. Anything like that would go a long way towards helping other people hear about the podcast. The CPT Podcast is a ministry of the Center for Pastor Theologians. You can learn more about the CPT by visiting us at pastortheologians.com. You can also find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our host for today's episode was Todd Wilson. Our producer and editor was Trenton Jones. Our music was composed by Andrew Gerlicher. I'm Zach Wagner. Thanks for listening.